morning. It's Thursday. It's 11 o'clock. It's time for your weekly environmental news magazine here on WFVR-LP, South Royalton. That would be Green Zine. Henry Swayze joining me, your co-host Todd Tyson. I'm in the studio. Henry's in the Queen City. We're looking forward to a visit from Earl Hatley. We're going to be talking about water rights, nature's rights, how they could be codified into the Vermont Constitution, and a whole lot more on Green Zine. Going to start off with Water of Love from Dire Straits.
High and dry in the long hot day, lost and lonely every way. Got the flats all around, sky up above. Yes, I need a little water of love. I've been too long lonely and my heart feels pain. Crying out for some soothing rain. Yes, I need a little water of love. Water of love, deep in the ground, but there ain't no water here to be found. Someday, baby, when the river runs free, it's gonna carry that water of love to me.
Well, this is Green Zine on Free Vermont Radio, brought to you today by Building a Local Economy. They're real busy. We'll tell you about e-bikes available over there. Tom Wells, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, and the Yes We Can Collective. I'm going to bring Mark down in the mix, and we'll bring Henry up in the mix. Good morning, Henry.
Good morning, Todd, and all you good listeners. We appreciate your tuning in and tuning into the environment as well as Green Zine.
That's right. Tuning into a positive environment. And I think with our visit from Earl Hatley, it's going to be on the positive side, but we're also going to point out some, rather dire circumstances that are happening in other parts of the world.
Lots of positive stuff, actually, from my perspective. So our topic today is the manage of our environment to maximize quality of life in the future for future generations.
Right.
And
the seventh generation, at least.
As Todd has pointed out, Earl Hatley is going to join us, and he is a Native American and has a campaign to grant the White River watershed personhood, and we will get into that and what all the implications of that are. And there's also, I'll put only in the show notes, in terms of water management and what has turned things around in the Sahel. There is a link there to local farmers figuring out how to regrow forests and change their availability of water and nutrition for growing agriculture. Mm. Real dramatic wake up and pay attention by looking.
Yeah, and just to clarify, Henry, not all our listeners know about where the Sahel region is. Can you do a little geography for us?
So it's an area of grasslands with trees scattered through it that are the bottom of the Sahara Desert.
Okay.
In the country of Niger. And the wisdom of Western money and capitalism decided that they should take down all the trees do modern farming and plow and plant crops, and the whole place dried up and nearly blew away. A lot of it blew away, and turned out that those trees they cut down were alive underground, and they selectively brought them back to life and turned the thing back into a productive landscape. That's the long and the short of that one.
So that's in the, that's in the show notes. Yep.
In the show notes. It wasn't the purpose of the show. The show is going to be about the White River and what the implications of when you grant personhood to nature or to a river shed. And that's what we're mainly focusing on here.
Very good.
Bird Note selected the selection and protection of habitats has big implications, and that's another we're going to look at that from Bird Note.
All right, we're going to go to that right now and take a little visit to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge here with Bird Note on Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio.
By telling vivid, sound-rich stories about Bird Note informs and inspires you, please consider supporting our stories. Make a donation at birdnote.org today.
This is Bird Note. It's the anniversary of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a place where wildlife photographer and sound recordist Garrett Vinn has spent a lot of time. Let's hear what he has to say about the wetlands there.
There's one habitat in Alaska that's probably most important for the widest number of species and the most number of birds as individuals in the entire state, and it's the Arctic Coastal Plain. And ironically, that's the one habitat type that has the least protection in the entire state. Less than 2% of the entire Arctic Coastal Plain is protected. In early June, millions of birds arrive there from all over the world to breed. All these different kinds of ducks, shorebirds, which are, you know, sandpipers, plovers, and other types of wading birds. All these birds go up there and they're feeding on this explosion of insect life that happens in the brief spring. And it's also a place that's very safe for them to nest because there's relatively few predators. So they're going to this place because it's safe and because there's lots of food, and trying to quickly breed and then move on again across the globe to where they spend the rest of the year.
From the American Birding Association to the U.S. Sportsmen's Alliance, from the National Audubon Society to the National Rifle Association, groups are joining together in support of funding to maintain wildlife refuges. Learn how you, too, can help. Begin at our website, birdnote.org.
All right. It made me think of Vermont possibly in the future. Well, even now, a safe place with plenty to eat, but up there for the birds in the spring in the ANWR, Henry.
Yes, there is. We do get our share of birds coming, migrating through Vermont and enjoying the explosion of insects we have in the spring.
Yeah, you know, I want to go off topic too much, but on the insect front, you know, I'm used to seeing all kinds of wasps during the summer, and paper wasps and hornets and yellow jackets, etc. A few bumblebees here and there, obviously honeybees. And I've noticed a significant downturn in seeing those flying critters. Have you noticed that too?
Absolutely. It's happening.
Yep, it's happening.
And it's caused by, I think, by a number of things. Certainly, on a grand scale, There was enormous die-off when DDT was still around. And that has there has been a bounce back after that.
Yes.
And certainly our weather conditions, we have less dew in the morning because we don't have as big a temperature shift from nighttime to daytime temperature.
Yeah, very noticeable.
As we used to have. And that's because we've pumped a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, especially from high altitude jet travel. And that has the greenhouse gas that the jets have done is not just the CO2, but it's the water vapor that they emit when they burn that jet fuel. And that is a very effective greenhouse gas, water vapor. And we think of it as being, well, it's very important, it's there, but it's obviously just there because, you know, moisture comes out of the ground, goes up to the clouds, forms clouds. There's always moisture in the atmosphere that's being recycled.
Mm-hmm.
But the jets are putting it in a place that doesn't wash back out of the atmosphere very well. And so it keeps our nights warmer. And the fact that we don't have that dew in the morning because of the radiational cooling at night, dropping the temperature further down, that means that there isn't a good drink for the insects out there. It's an extra repressor. At least that's my opinion. I'm not sure that every scientist would agree with me, but it's fascinating the way everything is in nature is linked together. It's all a complicated matrix, and when you push down here, something pops up over there. And it's not without consequence.
Right. And I guess, you know, just to point out that term, consequence, there are unintended consequences, things that people may not have known about that would be the result of certain human actions. And then there are, well, whether you want to call them intended consequences or malevolent or negligent or whatever, where things are being done, continue to be done as far as releasing greenhouse gases and other type of national policies in certain countries, that it's science has clearly shown the negative ramifications, and yet those activities continue.
Yes, that's the gloom and doom part of
there.
The show.
Sorry to bring that to you. I'll save some more gloom and doom towards the end of the show. Let's get positive here on Green Zine right now, Henry. We got about 5 or 6 minutes before we are joined by Earl Hatley, and really glad that we were able to get him to join the show today.
Yes, I serve with him on the Vermont Healthy Soils Coalition. Mm-hmm. He is a very active person. He's on dozens of different boards and things that he tries to assert a positive environmental effect and not just environment, spiritually to link up with the environment. And I think that's a very motivating and a powerful thing. That it's kind of part of why we do bird notes.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you stop to enjoy the birds, you realize that they're part of nature and we care about them, and let's pay attention and enjoy them and have that be something that improves our life instead of one more TikTok or whatever we might see on the screen.
Yeah, you know, another example of bringing positivity, but also with some spirituality, and whether it's you know, someone who's in a more formal church setting or just your own personal spiritual nature. We had the executive director of Vermont Interfaith Power and Light on a couple of months ago now, and that's a group of you know, many denominations part of that group, and they work with local you know, communities of faith to bring, you know, extra insulation to old buildings, to old churches, also providing support grants for putting up solar panels, for putting in EV chargers, etc. So there's people that are really sensitive to what's happening with the environment who actually take action and provide resources for local communities to improve and lessen, of course, fossil fuel production. So there are some really good things being done all around this country and, of course, around our community in the state of Vermont.
And a show that we did probably 2 years ago included a talk that Sophie Howe did to the Vermont legislature. And Sophie Howe is from the country of Wales. And Wales...
Isn't she the one who is the minister of the future?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember Sophie. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so she, Wales is the only country that has gotten together as a country and has said, well, what do we want to be in the future? What does Wales want to feel like? What do we consider a higher quality of life? And the country, through that discussion thing, came up with seven parameters that they thought were make their quality of life better. And then they signed them into law and said anything the government's doing has got to be able to argue successfully that it is helping with those goals for how we want Wales to be. And she was an independent person appointed to the government, not under political duress, to hold the government accountable for having done that. And since that was the kind of base quality of life change that that maybe giving personhood to rivers might do, I included her YouTube talk in the show notes. So after this show, we won't be hearing her, but after this show, you might enjoy. It's not very long. It's about 14 minutes in. And it would make sense, in my mind, to have the U.S. do that, too. So, anyway.
Yeah, there are a lot of qualified people who are not in the current administration, at least the federal administration, who would be able to be very good stewards of the future. And I really liked when we had that interview with her that future projects really needed to be brought to her and examined about what the ramifications of those projects would be. And I remember about reducing the speed limit and doing some other things there. So it wasn't like, hey, we made a deal with, you know, the head of the country or who's ever ahead of the, you know, the environmental department, et cetera, and we're going full blast ahead with our project. There were guardrails there. And there was another step to go through, very much, you know, sort of like the early stages of Act 250 here in the state of Vermont, being allowing development, but in a responsible manner that, you know, mitigates the negative, you know, ramifications in the future. Hey, Henry, we're just coming up on about 20 minutes after. I'm going to let you a hold of Earl, and I'm going to make an announcement while you guys are connecting. All right, you are listening to Green Zine here. And the announcement I'm going to make is something that's coming up this weekend on Sunday, and it is a tree social. I'm not the Lorax, but he does speak for the trees. And here comes the train. Mix, mingle, and toast the trees. That doesn't mean burn the trees. That means kind of giving them a show of support. The Tree Social is happening Saturday, so just in a couple of days from 2 to 5 p.m., and it's going to be on Back River Road. Join artist-in-residence Laura Nova for a forest mixer, a walkabout tree identification fascinator, hat-making, music, and refreshments in celebration of our arboreal, I don't get to say that enough, arboreal neighbors. Not the boring ones, but the arboreal ones. Come ready to meet your rooted neighbors, because good relationships require deep listening, mutual care, and kinship before we can truly tend one another. Address and parking information will be sent out prior to the event, and maybe we can post this. Or if you just look it up, there's a poster all around town. I don't have a specific address, but I'm sure you could track it down. So if you're looking for something to do, it's going to be a beautiful day on Saturday, 2 to 5 p.m. on the Back River Road. Join Laura, Nova, and a bunch of your tree-oriented neighbors. Let's see if Henry's been able to make that connection with Earl Hatley. Do we have you, Henry? Not yet. He'll be getting back in touch here pretty soon. You know what? I'm going to go back to, unless I hear Henry come on, we're going to go back to a little bit more of Water of Love, your tune to Green Zine.
If I don't get some water soon, I'll be dead and gone in the afternoon. Water.
All right. Hey, Henry, have you made your connection?
I have. So, Earl Hatley, with great pleasure, thank you for joining Green Zine today.
And it's a great honor. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, good morning, Earl. Always good to hear your voice and your insights, whether in person at some of the events that you've done here on the Green with Bail or over at the law school. And now I think this might be your second appearance here on Green Scene. So welcome back.
Well, thank you. And again, thanks for having me. It's a real honor to be able to speak with all of you and the folks listening.
Yeah. So, Earl, maybe you just can start off with that concept of granting personhood to some piece of nature. What's the deal? Why is that a good thing, and what kind of ramifications could it have?
That's a big question. And so,
yes.
A big answer is coming.
I'm trying to wrestle with how to start with that big.
Start small. Yeah, start small. Maybe how this all developed locally.
Yeah, well, it's. Are you talking about here in Vermont or just in general?
However you want to do it.
Yep.
Okay. Well, just in general. I'm working with the Center for Democratic and Environmental Rights, and they have been Thomas Lindsay, their lead, and who is an attorney, actually got his degree from Vermont Law School, has been for years now going all around the world. Writing laws for rights of nature. And so Brazil, Ecuador, New Zealand, and, you know, just all around the world, these constitutional amendments that have been passed, he wrote all of that. And then here in the United States, the tribes have taken the lead on passing rights of nature laws, rivers and nature in their jurisdictions. So there's a lot of precedent on this. Then we have Pittsburgh, Toledo, and Orange County, Florida, have passed rights of nature as well. These are, except for Orange County, these are two of these are municipal ordinances. And so the idea here is that nature has a right to exist, right to thrive, to regenerate, the right to evolve, right to perform natural species or ecosystems functions, the right to be restored, the right to habitat, the right to clean water, and the right to flow, the right to a healthy environment and climate. That's like the list of rights that nature has. I've worked with Thomas in several places around the country, beginning in Pennsylvania, when he and the Delaware Riverkeeper were working on an issue in Pennsylvania. And so there's a constitutional provision in their constitution that enabled them to go in and work with Pittsburgh on issues that they were dealing with there. Florida, Orange County passed a rights of nature for the streams, all the streams in Orange County. Let's see, in Toledo, it was the Lake Erie and the algal bloom situations there. Mm. Lake Erie passed rights of nature for the lake. So there is a lot of precedent in the United States, both civil law and tribal law, that has gotten all of this going. And so my approach essentially is, over the past 10 plus years, I've been watching the revisions of the Clean Water Act, deleting more and more streams from the Clean Water Act, leaving gaping holes in our environmental protections. I don't see states tightening that up that much, although I do see it here in Vermont. But even with the Clean Water Act, before it started being watered down, pun intended, there were still this gaping hole in our protections. And primarily I'm talking about wetlands and feeder streams to the main channels of these rivers. And in some cases, some rivers, according to the Republican Party, are not navigable, and therefore they should be deleted, and that's the attempt. So a stream like the Ottauquechee River, for example, here in Vermont, is one of those that is at risk for losing their Clean Water Act protections. Their tributaries and wetlands are already exempted. And so I've seen the efforts in the past, 2012, 2013, to for that towns were trying to do a rights of nature, just the broad rights of nature for their communities, and working toward a state law. And I read the state law that they are trying to pass, and it never went anywhere in Montpelier. In my opinion, it was because it was everything or nothing. And in my talks with ANR and conservation districts and other agencies that deal with water quality, they don't understand how this works within the current framework. Rather than blowing the current framework up and freaking everybody out, I'm trying to show them these are protections that don't exist, and the municipalities have the right to fill in those gaps for the protection of their communities. And so that's the approach that I'm taking. 24 VSA section 2291, number 14, authorizes municipalities to define what constitutes a public nuisance and to abate that nuisance. Hmm. And so this is the primary focus that I'm working on, is making the rights of the Ottauquechee River a potential nuisance claim for the municipality if someone is purposefully or accidentally dumping into the stream, or for some other reason there's a pollution problem that's being reported by locals in the area, and bringing that to the select boards. Then select boards can then work on solving the problem, and if they can't, then that person or those people can then speak for the river and go into nuisance court with a claim. Now, if the pollution is larger, then a nuisance court claim could handle and. Because you're not talking about very much money, from a nuisance claim. So if it's larger than that, then the select board can go to the A&R and report a potential Clean Water Act violation. And that brings in the state and their oversight to help fix the problem. This is the approach that I'm taking, is ordinances for each of the towns along the Ottauquechee River, Killington, Bridgewater, Woodstock, Hartford, and Heartland. For example, we've written ordinances for all of those towns working with the Vermont Law School, and now we're introducing those ordinances on building community support in each of the towns. Those community folks in those groups then will bring the ordinance to their select board. They're also working with their conservation commissions, and so I've been talking with conservation commissioners about them passing it and then recommending it to the select board as a way of doing this. And everyone is very receptive. We're just looking at, satisfying the legal guys, the legal eyes on this, that this actually is a level of protection that doesn't exist. And we're just adding this layer. We're giving rights to the river. We're empowering citizens in each of the communities to speak for the river, bringing the case forward to the select board, and then going into nuisance court and speaking for the river if it gets that far. Hmm. So that's the concept here. I've been talking with A&R and others that have Clean Water Act jurisdiction, and we're working to figure out, the legal mechanism for making this broader, more rivers than just the Ottauquechee, and how all this works. And everyone I'm working with is really great on this.
Yeah.
I hope that's not too long for you.
No, not at all.
I had mispromoted your effort as being all of the White River watershed, and you're actually working smaller scale on the Ottauquechee so that you can demonstrate that this can be done for bigger areas. And
I'm just using the Ottauquechee River. It's a 39-mile long stream, and it's really beautiful, and everyone loves this stream. It flows through the Quechee area. Ottaquedoc is what we call the village in Quechee.
Mm.
And so the river flows through there, flows through the gorge, And so it makes perfect sense to start small and demonstrate how it can be done on the Otakuichi and follow the and fit into the existing framework. That then opens up a bigger discussion. And yes, I want to turn to the White River next and start working along that stream. By that time, it'll make sense, and I'll have, you know, ripe enough conversations with DNR and others that we can figure out how to fit that into their framework in a way that makes sense to them, while we then work together on what it would take to get a state law and not just disrupt everything in the process, but actually get a state law that opens the door for them to fit this in. And so that's the strategy that I'm taking here in Vermont. And that's based on my experience in Oklahoma, where I'm from, and other states when we've worked on doing this. This makes the most sense.
My impression, Earl, and having met you several times before, is you were a person of immense patience. This is a long process that you've already been involved with for several years, and to actually maybe get it codified into law at the state level. And your efforts starting, like you say, the small stream, the Otakuichi eventually flowing in and joining the Connecticut and the White River, et cetera, that it's kind of like the headwaters. You're there at the headwaters, and things may gain enough and connectivity to have an impact. So how is it going with these sort of opening sessions with local concerned citizens who then are going to take this information to the next level, which is the select board? Give us an insight as to how some of those meetings have been going and the kind of questions you're getting, and whether they have been a real big step in the right direction.
Well, thank you. I launched all of this at the Vermont Law School on March the 14th when I brought in Thomas Lindsay from the Center for Democracy and Economic Rights and had an indigenous Abenaki panel with it. And so we made the presentations, and it was hugely received. We had a large crowd, and everyone was excited. And so through that process, I worked with all of them and got started organizing in the towns, because that seminar was our public launch after finishing writing up all of the ordinances. It took 2 years, you know, going through the semesters at the law school, getting it all researched and then written so that it fits, you know, within the structure of each of the towns. So once we were ready to launch, you know, we did that at that seminar, and then I've been in each town organizing a citizens group. And most of them were at the seminar, and so they were eager, and so that's what we're doing. The main thing that is important at this point is a groundswell of citizens within each town. And so we're lining up, talking in churches and to larger community groups in those towns to present all this and get folks organized and together on this. The only resistance, if you can call it that, is just the legal questions from the lawyers of the towns and other lawyers that are on conservation commissions as to how this would work. And I think we've got that mechanism satisfied. Everyone, legal guys that ask the questions, and, you know, once they hear the answers, they're, you know, they're fine. They just want to make sure it fits, you know. And they're not going beyond their bounds as a municipality. And this is why we targeted the nuisance as the best way to get the ordinances passed and fit within the framework of the towns and doesn't violate any of the Clean Water Act laws that the state is obligated to enforce. This actually is a layer they're not doing, and it fits.
Can you talk any about any of the other jurisdictions in the United States and who have adopted this kind of a personhood rights, and what kind of impact it's had on protecting natural environment?
Well, it's mostly all tribal at this point, with the exceptions that I spoke about, Pennsylvania,
Florida, Orange County.
Yeah, Toledo and Orange County. And then beyond that is a whole lineup of tribes that let's see if I can find out here real quick.
But I'm just wondering if it's had a positive effect, having done it. If you have any stories to tell about, oh well, since they have declared personhood, they've been able to improve things. So,
well, in Pittsburgh, they their rights of nature stopped was able to stop the fracking. The fracking for natural gas, and so it prevented that. They also tapped a constitutional provision in Pennsylvania that gives everyone the right. Let's see, how's it go? The right to clean air, water, and soil, something like that. And it's been a long time since I've read this. And so they targeted that and went after fracking in Pittsburgh, and they got it done. Lake Erie, town of Toledo, it was all about the algae blooms and the experiences they were having. And so Lake Erie then was recognized as having the rights to exist, flourish, and naturally evolve, and that residents of Toledo be recognized as having the right to a clean and healthy environment. So that's what they did, and they got that passed. 62% of Toledo voters voted for it.
And that would be an area, my guess, Toledo is not necessarily known as a bastion of liberalism as far as views.
Well, no. and neither is Orange County, Florida. And yet, that amendment was to give rights to all waters of Orange County, and it passed by 89%.
Wow. That's what I like to hear. Something that works for everybody, not just for one side of the coin. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, so that's very encouraging.
Can so you know? I want to get back locally here in Vermont, and these, I'll just call them sort of threshing meetings, informational meetings that are going to end up leading to local people from the same town as their select board coming before them. What has your experience been with the towns along the Ottauquechee with the planning commissions and the conservation commissions that maybe most of those towns have, and the critical role that they will play when they go before the select board?
Yeah, well, we're going to be working through the conservation commissions and getting their approval, and then taking it to the select board after the conservation commissions have passed it. Then they bring it to the select board for the select board to pass with a recommendation to pass, and that's all done by the community groups. Attending conservation commission meetings and then the select board meeting where it's considered. So it's important to have a groundswell of folks in their community wanting this to happen. We've worked very carefully in writing these ordinances so that they fit into their structure. and that this is just another nuisance possibility dealing with the river, which was given rights, and citizens were are empowered to speak for the river. So, yeah, I don't know if I'm answering your question, though.
No, I think you've covered it pretty well. I just know from a couple of nearby towns. We broadcast from the town of Royalton, and I'm aware of both the conservation committees in both of those towns. And, you know, it's kind of like not a labyrinth, but there are so many steps to be taken. You know, what are the views of the select board going into something like this? Do they feel like this is going to be too big a lift? How organized is the local conservation committee? Are they meeting on a regular basis so they can really discuss this thoroughly? I imagine it changes quite a bit from town to town. But as I said earlier, you know, kind of that tortoise pace, the patient part seems like it's going to be much more effective in the long run than the hare, which could get you know, sort of stymied if you go too quickly with this.
Well, yeah, you're making a really good point there, and that's why I'm being very patient and taking a long time to work this through. I actually am asking the select boards in Hartford and Heartland to back off for a little bit while we continue with the community organizing. I want to get bigger groups in those towns before they consider it. I want to be able to flood their rooms. So that's what it takes. And so the community organizing is still ongoing. And, you know, we'll do this when we get there, and we'll coordinate with the conservation commissions. They meet monthly. So, you know, we don't have to rush this. And I don't want to rush it. Just waiting for things to come around in the right way. And I think with that kind of patience, we can get this done and then continue on working toward ultimately the state law on at least rights of rivers. This is evolving. For example, the conservation commissions are saying we are not funded to take this on. And so they're recommending that we actually create a rights of nature commission within the towns to take on this responsibility for the Ota-Quechee in this example. And so that's how we're rolling with this. So we'll be creating I would say one of the towns is saying, well, you know, we have another stream that flows separately from the Ota-Quechee, and that's really our primary stream in our town. Why can't we add that? Well, of course you can add that. If you want to add every stream in that flows through your town, do it if you're inclined to, if that's what you want to do. And so I'm hearing things like that, and we'll see how it falls out for each town. That some may just be related to the Ota-Quechee, and others may want to add more streams or add all the streams in their towns. That's up to them. And they'll be creating a Rights of Nature Commission. At least I know two of them will. That's how we're moving forward with this. Just take the time to get it right and then do it, and then we can move forward, you know, to the next steps.
Yeah. Henry, I've got one more thing, but if you've got something, Henry, go ahead.
No, I think that's excellent. We've got a view into this, the stepping stone approach, I think, is probably the way to get it done. You're absolutely right. Because certainly the efforts in the past went to just do rights of nature across whole communities or across the entire state was maybe a bigger bone than anyone could swallow.
Yeah, it's too much, and it creates a backlash of reaction. How do we just blow up our government and do this, and how does that work? How do we enforce it? I mean, you hear wild conjecture when something like that hits, and the laws don't tell you how to do it, how to fit it in, how to enforce it. These are just broad general laws, and that's where you get the backlash. And so you really have to step in and be pragmatic of how this is going to work. Yeah. So pragmatism is the focus. I also want to leave you with another idea, and that's working on a conservation easement for property not far from me here. I won't name it on the air because mm-hmm. we're still working on this. But this forest land, we are writing rights of nature law into the conservation easement and working with VLT and VHCB board. We have a model that they are ready now to bring to their boards. And so in September, we may get our work passed for that conservation easement that gives rights to the forest. And DNR and others are saying, well, if once that passes, that is what we need in order to sell this throughout the agency. So that's coming. And another, once we are able to purchase the property, after getting the conservation easement approved, then we'll be working on giving title of the land to the forest. And that's Ooh. Been done in a couple of places now. The last one was in Colorado, where they gave not only rights to this mountain, but the mountain owns itself on the title.
Wow.
And so there's precedents in the United States now for this. There's a legal framework that works. And so that's the other thing I'll be bringing to Vermont is once we get this conservation easement passed, then we'll work on giving the forest its ownership. And these ownerships go, the way they work is that the forest owns itself. It owns the land on the title with Abenaki guardians monitoring and speaking for the property.
Yeah. Okay. A lot of responsibility placed on those poor Native Americans who have to be.
Well, in this case, we already have our guardians. So we're just trying to get them to pass this easement, and then eventually we change the title.
Yeah. Well, it could become the Lorax Law, because speaking for the trees there in that forest. Hey, Earl, it's been great hearing your insights. And the question I have, actually, I'm going to hold off for another future guest that they don't even know they're going to be a future guest. But part of this discussion will be brought up with that future guest. So thanks for joining us here on Green Zine.
Thank you. It was an honor. And thank you so much for the opportunity.
Yeah, and keep up the good work. That's just an enormous amount of patience that you exhibit, and sticking with the task of making things right instead of winner take all.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, very good. We've got about 6 minutes left in the show, Henry, and I'm just briefly going to go to this story that was in the New York Times as part of their climate forward update. And this is, a little bit, but it's reality. So I wouldn't necessarily call it gloom and doom. It has to do with water and a lack thereof. Story written by Reese Thibault of the New York Times. It's called America's Desert Metropolis is on the short list to lose water. Decades ago, Arizona won funding for a massive Colorado River project by agreeing to be the first in line for cuts at a time of deep drought. Our current administration says that time has come. And just to go to The Central Arizona Project is what it's called, that takes water from the Colorado River and brings it primarily into Phoenix and the surrounding area, and then it goes down towards Tucson. And if this decision is sort of confirmed, Phoenix could lose 30% of the water that they currently get from the Central Arizona Project. We know that that is one of the, over the last 20, 30 years, one of the fastest growing areas. They already have major water problems in a lot of the new developments that have been going in there. So it's a story to pay close attention to. One other thing, so that's I'm going to stop with the gloom and doom right there. That's not here, but water issues are a international issue. It's not just out in the Southwest here, and protecting water, extremely important. The good news here for those who want to try out an e-bike with no obligation is that Bail is currently, through help from Vital Communities, is offering four different e-bikes through September 2nd. They're over. I was just in the office. I've got my eye on one. I might even ride it after the show. Go to bailvt.org. To find out, basically all you're doing is signing out, almost like going to the library. It's an e-bike lending library. Go there, sign it out, sign off on a liability waiver. Make sure you know how to ride an e-bike. They're very heavy, I can tell you that. I brought one down the front steps. Be very careful. Maybe bring a strong person with you if you don't feel like you can get it down the steps. And have your helmet with you. And go for a ride on the Back River Road. So once again, you can get information at bailvt.org, and they have those four bikes available to our local population here through September 2nd. Okay, back to you, Henry.
Yeah, just on the subject of e-bikes, I have one, and I love it. I think it's there's a lot of, I'm seeing around Burlington, the student population and the lower income population in Winooski and in this area. A lot of those people are riding on electric scooters and electric bikes that are can actually be out in the traffic and are really kind of like little motorcycles. And I hardly recommend for your own health that you get an e-bike that doesn't go without pedaling. You can make it so that it's, so that the electric is assisting, and then you actually get exercise when you're on them instead of just being in a two-wheel car that doesn't give you any exercise when you travel from point A to point B.
I went through the e-bike years as I went carefully around the green without a helmet on, but we'll take care of that. They come in like 3 to 4 different speeds, the ones that really will not go more than 20 miles per hour with pedal assist. So the lowest speed, which is almost just like pedaling the bike without any assists, is usually called eco mode. And the top is often called turbo. I would not go to turbo unless you really feel that you're kind of on a back road and it's a really steep hill and there's no other traffic around. So I agree, Henry. There are two classes of e-bikes, maybe even three, but those ones that are often called e-motos are very dangerous, and in an urban area like Burlington, there have been some accidents, and very young people should not really be permitted to be on that type of a bike. Hey, before I go, and before we go here on Green Zine, let's acknowledge our underwriters one more time. They do include Bail, the folks that are hosting that e-bike lending library. Also, Tom Wells is working on his property today up in Tunbridge. Daniel Leibowitz, who appeared on a regular bike and took a bike ride with me and a couple of other friends a couple weeks ago. The Upper Pass Beer Company now has a facility up at the north end of Tunbridge, but originally starting in the town of Tunbridge. And finally, yeah, we're collecting cans. The Yes We Can Collective, it all adds up, and we keep them out of the waste stream. Henry, got a little bit of water sound underneath us. You got any closing remarks?
Yeah, I do. On next week's program, we will have George White, who is a contractor and is winding down his contracting. He may be continuing some, but he's looking at retirement. And he has done a lot of work tightening up houses and making them energy efficient. And we'll talk about just how good a house can get and what you can do to get there.
Oh, that's a great topic. Good to hook up with George White. Henry, here comes Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us. We'll hear and see you all next week.